Disasters are a reality of life in the Pacific, but so is the strength and resilience of its people. Pacific Prepared shares first-hand stories from communities on the ground, drawing on tradition, culture, and collective wisdom to stay safe and support one another in times of disaster. Pacific Prepared explores how communities are adapting and protecting what matters most. Search up ABC Pacific Prepared to listen online or find it wherever you get your podcasts.
This is an ABC podcast.
On Sunday, almost everyone in the Pacific will be at church. From small village chapels to concrete cathedrals in capital cities, the week pauses and faith takes center stage. Across the Pacific, Christianity is the dominant religion. Catholic, Protestant, evangelical, faith brought by missionaries and reshaped, claimed, and woven into Pacific life. But in the Pacific, Christianity doesn't stop at church doors. It flows into parliament, into constitutions, into laws, leadership, and national identity.
Shall we bow our heads in prayer? We lift up, Heavenly Father, to you today, our elected leaders, and we ask that you surround them with love and grace.
Hi, I'm Scott Whitey, and this is Polytalk. When faith moves beyond the pulpit into politics, what happens to democracy? Today, we're zooming in on Samoa and Fiji to examine how religion is shaping leadership, law, and power. In Samoa's capital, Apia, church bells ring out to welcome the faithful to worship. On Sundays, the country slows, streets empty, and families gather in pressed white shirts and lava-lavas and puletasis. Samoa is one of the most Christian nations in the world. Around 98% of people identify as Christian. Despite this overwhelming majority, other religions have long been free to worship here. On Fridays, Imam Hussam al-Din Stanley welcomes Muslims to his mosque on the outskirts of the capital.
We are not that well known because our brothers and sisters here, Muslims here, we come here and then we live our life peacefully. So basically, we're just living our own life in a peaceful way. And that's why many people don't know. Islam has been in this country for more than 30 years.
But the quiet balance that's allowed communities like his to exist is now being tested by Samoa's Prime Minister, Laulielei Malietoa Polataivao Fosi Schmidt, who is proposing a ban on non-Christian faiths after vowing a God-centered leadership.
It makes a lot of sense. And, you know, Laulielei's rise to power is very much due to that very strong Christian underpinning of our culture and of our history.
Dr. Langipuiva Cheryl Jackson is a professor of Pacific Island Studies at Portland State University in the United States.
So he is the leader today because not only is he a very skilled orator and chief, he is also a deeply faithful, devout, and openly Christian leader.
Christianity arrived in Samoa in the 1800s. First came the missionaries, then the Roman Catholic Church, followed by the Methodists.
Christianity arrived, or when the missionaries arrived in Samoa, they justified their arrival through a prophecy that the woman warrior, or a woman warrior, Nafanua, had said prior to their arrival, which is that light will arrive in Samoa, Iao Samoa. So when Christianity and the missionaries arrived, they utilized that approach by Nafanua to justify themselves being in the country and also for the chiefs to then fully accept them. So that's kind of how religion and Christianity was firmly accepted within our culture and ultimately integrated into the Samoan culture.
Langipuiva explains that before Christian contact, Samoan society placed women and high chiefs at the top of the social hierarchy. But when the church arrived, power shifted.
And so the whenganga, which is what we call the pastor, then became prioritized, or it superseded other cultural roles. So it then became this very harmonious coexistence between the chiefly system and church leadership and the church hierarchy. So whenever you see a gathering, an official gathering in Samoa, you will see that generally the pastors or the reverends sit in the middle and then flanked by chiefs.
Today, Samoa is deeply devout. On a single drive from the airport into the capital, Apia, you'll pass around 90 churches just along 30 kilometers of road. There are more than 400 churches spread across the country, with many on the Prime Minister's home island of Savai, the place where he founded the FAST Party.
The Honorable Prime Minister's founding of FAST really responded to something that was missing in Samoa for a long time.
In 2020, Laulielei Malietoa resigned from the ruling Human Rights Party, which governed Samoa for 4 decades. He offered voters a political movement campaigning on governance and reform. FAST swept to power, delivering Samoa's first female prime minister, Fiamme Naomi Mataafa.
Fiamme Naomi Mataafa defeated the ruling party of more than 40 years to become the country's first female head of government.
But by 2025, internal divisions and legal charges against Laulielei Malietoa plunged the party into turmoil. FAST expelled Fiamme as leader, reinstalled Laulielei Malietoa, and he was soon elected prime minister. At his swearing-in ceremony, he wore a prayer shawl and a cross necklace, a clear signal of how closely faith would sit at the center of his leadership.
I think with Honorable Prime Minister Laulielei's current approach is that there's really no separation between church and state now for Samoa. He is freely implementing policies and proposing activities for public servants that are very much about Christianity.
Since coming to power, he's moved quickly to stamp his religious agenda on parts of Samoan society. His government has made weekly fasting and prayer mandatory for public servants. And he's proposed a ban on non-Christian religions as a way to counter religious extremism. He's also asked the nation's peak Christian body, the Samoa Council of Churches, to advise him on the country's religious freedom views.
Samoa is not officially a theocracy just yet, but Christianity continues to hold a very privileged constitutional position in Samoa. Samoa's constitution recognizes it as a Christian nation, and so public life is shaped by Christian norms, and our culture has continuously been impacted and adjusted to cater to Christian norms.
But under the Prime Minister's new proposals, Langipuiva says the line between faith and state is beginning to blur. Samoa has already moved in that direction before. Christian instruction became mandatory in public primary schools in 2011. Parliament amended the constitution, formally declaring Samoa a Christian nation.
Because of the history of Samoa and that harmonious relationship between Christian and state, it has been respectfully observed between the two, and there's always been religious freedom in Samoa. But now with the new leadership and the Prime Minister's leaning towards preferring one particular religion over another, that then becomes the question of, are we heading towards that direction?
Behind the scenes, Langipuiva says concern is growing inside the government itself.
You know, there are people who have been working in government for many, many years who are concerned about this lean towards a certain religious state.
Still, there is strong public support for Laulielei Malietoa's approach. His roots in Savai, his standing as a high-ranking traditional chief, and his identity as a deeply faithful leader have resonated with many voters.
You know, the fact that he is from Savai wields great power in Savai to get himself to this point where he's recognized as a traditional leader, but also recognized as a deeply faithful leader. So, in seeing this, it's not surprising that he has risen to power in this way, because there was always an appetite for it among our people.
For Langipoiva, that popularity is precisely what makes this moment so pivotal.
There's a concern for Samoa's democratic systems and for Samoa's status as a democratic nation. Already under this current prime minister, there has been threats to freedom of the press, and there is now a threat to potentially freedom of religion. Those are two very important fundamental human rights. And, you know, what this begs the question of how far will the current prime minister go to really infringe upon those very basic rights that are fundamental to a free and fair society and a healthy democracy? You know, only time will tell.
Politok has reached out to Prime Minister Laaulia Le Malietoa's office, but it did not respond before the deadline. Like Samoa, Christianity arrived in Fiji in the early 1800s, carried by British missionaries and backed by colonial power. Conversion didn't just change belief. It reshaped authority, education, and governance. 200 years later, Crystal Whippy is watching how religion still interacts with politics.
I don't think we've ever had a leader who hasn't professed some sort of link to Christianity.
She's a human rights advocate and the founder of Tracking Democracy Fiji.
So Fiji being a former colony, so a lot of my advocacy also focuses on decolonization practices. I don't see in the way that our government functions, in the way that our society functions, that we have fully and properly decolonized. So how that relates to Christianity and religion here in Fiji is, when we go back to colonization, Christianity was the methodology used by these colonial entities to take control of the education system.
She says history matters because today in Fiji, Christianity still carries enormous symbolic weight. Most political leaders openly identify as Christian, and religious language is woven into speeches, ceremonies, and national events. But unlike Samoa, Fiji's constitution enshrines a secular democracy, protecting freedom of religion in a multi-faith society, including Hindus, Muslims, and Christians. The tension, Crystal says, isn't in the law, it's in the influence.
There's still this idea that people need to make sacrifices and default to whatever it is that their pastor or their priest thinks should be happening within the country, as opposed to thinking independently and doing what is best for their community.
And that influence, she says, is felt most sharply by those on the margins.
We're always seeing that women should be modest. Women should be protecting themselves in some way. It's a lot of the blaming the victim sort of rhetoric. Then there's also the LGBTQ issues that we have. There's still a lot of ignorance being perpetuated.
And interwoven in all of this is the role religion plays in foreign diplomacy issues. Fiji's Prime Minister Sitiveni Rambuka, who was once a Methodist minister, has opened a Fijian embassy in Jerusalem. Mr. Rambuka has denied it is a religious decision and called it a strategic step to enhance cooperation between the two countries. The official Jewish population in Fiji is tiny, yet the connection to the core religious aspect of Israel ties in with the Pacific's deep and entrenched Christian values.
I mean, from a young age, I grew up in a household where Christianity, even though they weren't, you know, strict or staunch Christians, it was still the predominant narrative. And so I remember hearing about how Israel and the chosen people and all of that rhetoric, and that's still being, you know, propagated today. That's still being mimicked.
And Crystal says the problem isn't belief itself. It's when belief overrides democratic responsibility.
It's fine to have leaders who belong to a particular faith, but the fact is, in a democracy, they're leaders of everyone, not just the people who, you know, follow their particular faith or go to the same church or whatever it is. Once someone becomes prime minister, they take public office, they are responsible for everyone, for policies that affect everybody.
Politok has reached out to Prime Minister Rambuka's office for comment, but has not received a response. So in all of this, how does the church see its relationship in Pacific politics?
For answers, I went to the Secretary General of the Pacific Conference of Churches, Reverend James Bhagwan.
I was brought up in a very strong Christian family with parents who were very much involved in their local church. And so for me, growing up, that's how I saw faith, one that is practiced not only on Sundays or in church spaces, but that is lived in society and in community.
Now, what led you to choose ministry as a vocation?
Well, you know, funny story. My mother, when I was a little boy, told me that, like Samuel, you know, she had prayed for a son, and I was dedicated to being dedicated by my parents to serve God. Of course, at that time, I thought nothing of it. But then, you know, life happens, and you know, working in radio and television over many years, something was still not satisfying, and actually, I started studying theology just as a way to engage my own faith, and that for me led to a call to enter ministry. So you know, perhaps I was one of those prodigal sons that returns and takes up the path that they should have already have done for much earlier in life.
Can you give us a bit of a background on the Fijian church and where you served for many years as a Methodist leader? What does church life look like in Fiji?
Yeah, church life is deeply woven into everyday community life here in Fiji. It's not just limited to Sunday worship. You know, we have choir practices, men and women's fellowships, youth groups. There are pastoral visits, Sunday school activities. You know, we have funerals, weddings, community obligations. And these all form part of the weekly rhythm of life. And in many rural communities in Fiji, you know, life is ordered through the activities of the church. And for indigenous Fijians in particular, the Methodist Church has historically been closely linked with identity, with the Vanua, and church spaces are places of belonging, of cultural community, of moral formation. So faith is lived communally rather than individually or privately. And this closeness has been a source of strength. The church has sustained communities through hardship, displacement, political instability. It's provided networks of care and solidarity across generations. But at the same time, this closeness has created challenges. When faith becomes inseparable from ethnic or political identity, it becomes vulnerable to misuse. And Christianity can be framed as belonging to one group rather than being good news for all. And this is the challenge sometimes we see in Fiji. You know, growing up in the Methodist Church, which at times went through, which has gone through this process of, you know, at one stage in the 80s and 90s, and even into 2000, there were times during political unrest where the church was very ethnocentric or ethno-nationalist, some very racist spaces in the Methodist Church in Fiji to where it is now.
Now, you came into ministry in Fiji during the periods of profound political instability, coups, constitutional changes, and social tension. What do you remember most vividly about what it felt like to be a church leader during those very turbulent moments?
Yeah, as a young minister, what I remember most vividly was the weight of moral responsibility, the weight of what it means to be a Christian leader in my community, and then serving in a national church office, you know, supporting the leadership of the day who were also struggling with this weight, you know, and during coups, political unrest, people came to church afraid, confused, searching for guidance. And we had to remember that words spoken from pulpits carried enormous consequences. And, you know, at the same time, the church itself was divided during the coups of 87 and 2000. And, you know, the parts of the Methodist Church aligned themselves, as I said earlier, with national, ethno-nationalist politics and gave theological justification to unconstitutional actions. And that caused deep harm politically, socially, and spiritually. But the church was never one voice. There were still pastors and lay leaders who resisted, who defended democracy and paid personal costs for doing so. Some were marginalized or silenced. And living through this period taught me that leadership in crisis is not about popularity, but about integrity. And that silence can be just as damaging as complicity. And those experiences shaped my conviction that the church must never again baptize political power.
When politics and faith collided in those moments, what did you see power actually look like? How did you see it?
I think it's very much what we see in some spaces today, that power looks most dangerous when it's wrapped up in religious language. And when political agendas claim divine approval, dissent is then framed as disobedience to God. And that kind of power silences conscience, it legitimizes harm. And I saw quickly in these states, in these cases, how faith could be weaponized to justify exclusion, to justify even violence. And religious symbols and scriptures, you know, at times were used to sanctify political actions that contradicted the core values of the gospel. But at the same time, I witnessed another form of power, moral courage. Leaders who refused to bless violence and communities who chose restraint over revenge. And that's, for me, is the power that the church is meant to exercise. And these contrasts, help me understand authority, because true power in the church, it's relational. It's not coercive. It persuades rather than dominates. And it calls people towards justice rather than forcing compliance.
From your experiences out of Fiji, I mean, how important is it for a politician to seek legitimacy through association with the churches?
Well, I think that's the big issue, that in reality, you cannot seek legitimacy from being associated with the church, because the church is not about association. The church is about how one lives one's life, how one makes decisions, how one acts in the interests of particularly the poor and vulnerable. And many times that actually goes against the grain of politics, which is about majority rules. It's about popularism and things like that. And so I think that's the challenge that we face when people seek endorsement from a particular church without actually subscribing or scribing to the ethos or the ethics and the, you know, the principles, the values of the Christian life. And we see that more and more, where Christian, instead of people, you know, following the path, they are just wrapping themselves up in Christian language, symbols, imagery, to be seen to be Christian rather than to actually live the Christian way. And you know, in this day and age, I think we get caught up in that rather than in the depth of what someone is meant to be and do in society.
Is there a moment in Pacific history where you think the church's political power became very clear?
I think so. I think particularly, you know, we see in the founding of the Pacific Conference of Churches in the 1960s, the establishment of the Pacific Theological College, which is now the Pacifica Communities University. Those were moments of the churches, church leaders saying the church needs to be more involved. And you can see this involvement in terms of the life, the self-determination of Pacific people. And so very early on, when we have things like the nuclear-free and independent Pacific movements, you see the church being part of that movement and continuing to play a role in self-determination, in, you know, things around nuclear justice, etc. And so, you know, the early 60s, we see that fruit of what was coming through from other churches, partner churches on liberation theology and things like that.
Looking back over the church's history, are there moments where the Pacific Church has held too much power or failed to challenge power when it should have?
I think this is true of every faith community when we are really embedded in our communities. Because the role of the church in relation to politics is to engage without being captured. Historically, churches have had moments of moving too close to political power, sometimes out of fear, sometimes out of the desire to protect culture or privilege. And I think we are starting to understand the cost of that in different countries and hopefully across the region. And it's important for us to understand the difference between the church as an institution and the church, you know, as a community of faith. And remembering that first and foremost, it is accountable to the gospel, not to state, not to political ideology. And if an institution forgets that essence, it becomes, you know, defensive, it becomes nationalistic, it becomes partisan, or its leaders look for privilege or to protect privilege. And that's the challenge for us, we've seen.
As Secretary General of the Pacific Conference of Churches, you're leading an institution that governments listen to. Do you see the Pacific Church today as a political actor?
I think so. As I said, you know, there are times when the church is called to speak. And when we speak, we don't only speak to politicians. We make statements that are there for everyone. But particularly when there are spaces for us to engage in with leadership in our region. And you know, being a region that for the majority is of the Christian faith, the role that the church plays for individuals is the same as it plays for organizations. You know, for example, last year at the Pacific Island Forum Leaders Meeting in Honiara, PCC, along with the Solomon Islands Christian Association, hosted the church service before the leaders meeting began. And that was a time of spiritual grounding. It was a time of, seeking God's discernment and guidance in the meetings that were going to be held throughout that week. And then 2 days later, myself and two other church leaders from the Solomon Islands were part of the civil society dialogue with the leaders. And so there are different spaces and ways for engagement that we engage in. And I think this is the role of the church, to find ways to engage and provide guidance, provide wisdom.
You've been very outspoken on issues like climate change, democracy, minority rights. How do you decide when to speak publicly, and how do you weigh the political consequences of saying those things?
A lot of prayer. these things are not exercises in mental exercises as much as prayer and spiritual exercises. But, you know, deciding when to speak publicly is an act of discernment. It's not automatic, you know, because I recognize that every time we speak, it's not without consequences. So, you know, the question is, you know, is human dignity at stake? Is our silence causing harm? Have we attempted to have dialogue first? And so if the answer to those questions then point towards injustice or suffering, then the church has a responsibility to speak, even if it's uncomfortable or politically costly. And at PCC, this discernment is done collectively. We don't respond to every political issue. But as I said, where faith, justice, survival intersect, that's where you're going to find the church.
Now, looking ahead, as Pacific nations face, you know, issues of climate change, migrations, and the geopolitical competition, you know, we've got questions like Israel, Gaza, Ukraine, America's involvement in the Pacific. What role do you think the church will play in shaping those political outcomes?
I call it looking beyond the reef and scanning the horizon and seeing what's happening in other parts of the world, because, you know, things tend to come to the Pacific a little later on, but they still do come here. And how do we address these issues? So how does the church in the Pacific speak to the issue, for example, of Christian nationalism, which has been an issue for us in the past and continues to be an issue in some spaces? How do we address the issue of authoritarianism, which is growing in the United States and other places? How do we look at the issue of Christian Zionism, for example? And the church needs to be able to both serve the community, but also address issues of injustice, particularly structural injustice.
Rev, thank you very much.
Naka, thank you so much.
Polytalk is hosted by me, Scott Wyde. Our producer is Kuntamari Crofts. Our supervising producer is Jordan Fennell. And our executive producer is Faleanga Fulu. Inga Stunzner.